The date the French remember is July the 14th, because 200 years ago, on that date, a mob of peasants and middle-class radicals and disaffected militia seized control of the Bastille, an old fortress on the east side of Paris. In terms of strategic importance, it was an achievement of very little value. There was only a handful of prisoners inside, and I'm told at least two of them were mad. Certainly none of them were prisoners of any great political weight. But in symbolic terms, it was without any question the turning point of French history. For the Bastille represented to the people the old system, the Ancien Régime, as it was called. It was a regime which had been invested with great authority and eminence in French minds for centuries. And Louis XIV in particular had established it in what were then modern times, or relatively modern times, as an unshakable foundation of the French constitution. I've tried to outline it here on the left. Three things are worth noting about the Ancien Régime, the old system, which the French Revolution was to overthrow. First of all, it was perceived to rest on divine authority. And that's what gave it, in part, its huge stability. Things which human beings think they've created, they feel they have the right to change at will. But those things which we feel come down to us from God form a sort of basis for civil order, which is much more difficult to feel you have the right to change. And the old system of French society, quite definitely, was brought to the people as that with that kind of divine right to exist. The second thing to notice about it is that it institutionalized social privilege in a very gross way. It rested on the so-called three estates in France, the three classes, as we would probably call them. There was, first of all, the aristocracy, with the king as its patron and head. The aristocracy made up in part of the military aristocrats of blood, who were called noblesse d'épée, and the added to them in more recent years, in 1789, had been the merchant class, the wealthy merchant class, who had purchased authority in the civil courts and in local government, and had so joined the ranks of the nobility in their own minds, the so-called noblesse de robe. These aristocrats had huge privileges and advantages, chief among them the king. Perhaps the most notorious privilege which he had was the so-called lettre de cachet. This was the power possessed by the king to imprison anybody without trial indefinitely, simply on the writing of a letter. Some who were in the Bastille, perhaps, had been incarcerated by that means. And it was for that reason that Bastille represented the old system to the populace. Alongside the king and the aristocracy was the church. Now, if it had worked well, I suppose the church could have been the conscience of the nation, could have been a corrective balance to the authority of the aristocracy. But it didn't work that way. For the Catholic Church had for a long while been enmeshed in the political power system in Europe. And certainly at the higher levels of its hierarchy, the bishops and cardinals saw themselves simply as allies of the aristocracy in the main. So there was a kind of axis of power between the aristocracy and the church being the second estate, but who regarded themselves as still very much superior to the common people, the third estate. Now, these common people were made up in large measure by peasantry, rural peasants, but not entirely. Increasingly, at the end of the 18th century, this third estate also included a middle class, people who were growing in numbers, living in the cities, making their living through industry or trade, but who still had no access to the corridors of power represented by the church and the aristocracy, who were effectively disfranchised. So there was a huge them and us feeling about France in the 18th century. And for a long while, it was clear that change needed to happen, or else the situation was going to blow up. Unfortunately, the Ancien Régime, the old system, was far too immobile and inflexible, and the aristocracy and the church far too defensive of their privileges and their advantages to permit that change to take place. A And so, in the end, change overtook the system. The surrender of the Bastille to the Parisian populace marked the collapse of that old political system. Is it a big rebellion? Louis XVI asked his advisor Rochefoucauld. No, sire, was the reply. It's a big revolution. Revolution it was, a breakdown in the system, and it propelled France into a decade of anarchy and terror. The irony is that by the end of the century, France had executed her king and put in his place an emperor, Napoleon Bonaparte. That is the irony of so many revolutions. They so often result in regimes just as autocratic and dictatorial as the ones they were trying to displace. We overthrow the Tsar, we get Lenin. In fact, on the streets of Peking in these last few weeks, we've once again seen how revolution is no recipe for freedom. So often it results in even more entrenched power caucuses and elites. Revolutions simply don't produce the utopian societies that those who initiate them are often dreaming about. The question I want us to look at is, how should a Christian respond to such revolutionary movements? See, the fall of the Bastille took place 200 years ago, it's true. But that revolutionary ethos which the event represented is very much a contemporary and relevant issue. For now, with the writings of Marx and Lenin, revolutionism has an ideological foundation, a foundation which has had enormous intellectual support in our 20th century. And for many oppressed and disadvantaged groups in the Third World today particularly, revolutionary violence seems to be the only hope they have for recovering human freedom and dignity. They too, you see, feel themselves, like the French Third Estate, to be the victims of a them and us division, with the them having all the power, and the us being completely deprived of it. The French answer, the revolutionary answer, is to turn the regime on its head. To cut God out of the equation, that's for sure. The French Revolution was a decidedly atheistic affair. Although it tried to moderate that in various ways, there was quite clearly a very anti-clerical feeling to the French Revolution. The Catholic Church had been perceived as an ally of the system, and the revolutionaries did not lose much time in secularizing the state. In fact, for a while during the revolution, the great cathedral of Notre Dame was dedicated not to God at all, but to the goddess Reason. Incidentally, that great statue which the Chinese students put up in Peking Square, a replica of the Statue of Liberty, which stands in New York Harbor, that, you know, very much epitomizes the idolatry of the goddess Reason, of the goddess Freedom, which comes from that French spirit at the end of the 18th century. It was the French who gave the Americans the Statue of Liberty. And I suspect if they really understood its ideological implications, the Americans would be rather less proud of it than they are. The real symbol of American liberties, the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, with its roots in the Puritan revolution of the Pilgrim Fathers. That Statue of Liberty, I'm afraid, represents an altogether different kind of democracy from the one that America has actually espoused. But a little more about that later on. What the revolutionaries did was to cut God out and enthrone the people as the sovereign in the state. It was an obvious solution. The reason the people were being oppressed is because they had been denied power. What could be more obvious then than to put the people on top? Give them the sovereign power in the state. Then there would be freedom and equality and brotherhood. So a true revolution, a turning upside down of the system. How should Christians respond to that solution, to the problem of power inequality and oppression in the world today? That's the question I want us to address from the Bible this evening. And there are three passages we're going to look at which are of relevance to it. We can do no more than skate over them. I promise you this isn't going to be a two-hour spectacular. We're going to finish shortly after seven. But there are three passages which we are going to look at briefly to see the relevance that they have for this question.
The passages come from Romans 13, Acts 5, and 1 Peter 2, which we read earlier. What I want to try and offer you is a biblical alternative model, both to the ancien régime and to the revolutionary system, which the Paris revolutionaries tried to put in its place. A model which, it seems to me, the Bible presents to us. We'll start with Romans 13, a passage which is a sort of classical location in the Bible for all discussions relating to politics and the authority of the state. In it, Paul is saying something really quite similar to what Peter was saying in those early verses of the passage we read. In fact, Peter might even be quoting Paul. Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against God, what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. Now, the heart of all questions regarding revolution is the question of why should I obey the state? What right has the state got to tell me what to do? When and if have I got the opportunity and the right to disobey the state? It's, I think, important to realize that two philosophical strands, political philosophical strands, were working in Europe at the end of the 18th century and contributed to the French revolutionaries' thinking on this matter. One was the writings of John Locke, a political philosopher, who argued that governments have the right to obey us, to be obeyed by us, because citizens have entered into a kind of contract, a kind of trust, perhaps is a better word, to obey the state. There is a kind of relationship, an agreement between the individual and the state, by which the individual voluntarily surrenders some of his private freedom in order to enjoy the security provided by the government. Security against injustice and against external aggression, for instance. Now, Locke's view was very, very influential in the American War of Independence, which those of you who know your history will remember occurred just 20 years or so before the French Revolution. And the French were quite heavily implicated, you may recall, in the American War of Independence. In fact, I doubt whether the Americans could have won it without them. You see, Locke argued that if a government exceeded the terms of the trust or the contract, then the citizens were justified in rebelling and overthrowing that government. So Locke provided a remedy for tyranny, a revolutionary remedy. The trouble, of course, with his view is that if people really believe that they're only to obey the state insofar as they have given the state authority, that the government only has the right to constrain their obedience insofar as they have entered into a voluntary pact to give the government that right, then frankly, anarchy is not far away. For every individualist revolutionary who says to himself, but I don't want the government to control me in that way, is legitimized. Trouble with Locke's view is that it justifies a revolution too easily. But certainly his views were going around at that time. And it was one democratic alternative, if you like, that was being discussed, which placed the people over the state, at least in certain circumstances, and said they had the right to displace the state. But perhaps more important than Locke, as far as the French Revolution was concerned, was the French writer Rousseau. He had a few years before written a very important book, Du Contrat Social, in which he said, governments have the right to be obeyed if they express the general will of society. He said everybody has two wills. It's a rather strange point of view, but it's not difficult to understand. He said all of us have a sort of selfish, personal will, what I want. But all of us, he says, also have a general will, what we want, because we're part of an organism, a society. And he said, the job of a government is to express the general will of society. Government, he said, has the right to coerce obedience to the general will, because it's what we really ought to want, as opposed to our mere selfish whims. How do you find the general will, Rousseau? Well, of course, the obvious way is by voting. You find out what the general will is by taking a vote. Government has the right, then, to enforce the will of the majority. That's what it comes down to. Now, modern ideas of democracy largely stem from this concept. The trouble, of course, with this view, well, there are many problems with it, quite apart from the fact that it has no defense of minority interests, the trouble with this view is that once any group of people have actually got control, say, through being elected into office, they then become the mouthpiece of the general will. And there is no limit on their power. For anything the general will decrees must be done. This is how it is, you see, that totalitarian parties have sometimes been elected, in fact, quite often are elected in our world today, and dignify themselves with titles like the Democratic Republic and so on. Once a government has seized the majority at the ballot box, it becomes the mouthpiece of the people. Now, I think it's very important to realize that the Bible doesn't endorse either of those theories of government. It doesn't agree with Locke that governments only have the right to rule on the basis of an agreement from the people. And I don't think it agrees with Rousseau that the power of government is legitimized by popular vote. In fact, that idea was quite unknown to the Bible. These ideas had huge effects in France. Many of the atrocities and crimes that were carried out during the Reign of Terror by the state were due to this mistaken idea that the general will must always be done, no matter what it decrees. Now, the Bible insists that the authority of government is primarily a moral authority and that its power to constrain obedience derives from the sovereignty of God. That's why in my model there you will see God is at the top and the law of God stands above the state. That's how the Bible sees it. To give an analogy, on what basis are you and I expected to obey the commandment, thou shalt not kill? Is it because, as a society, we have passed a democratic resolution that this shall be our law? No, I suggest to you it's more than that. Is it then because we have voluntarily entered into an agreement to be bound by such a law? No, I suggest to you it's more than that. This moral law, thou shalt not kill, comes to us as a divine imperative from above. It's not something we have to agree to, it's not something we have to vote on. Our Creator has placed us under this law. We don't have to agree with it, we don't have to vote on it, we simply ought to obey it. Now, it seems quite clear to me that Paul in Romans 13 insists that men and women ought to obey civil governments for a similar reason. It's a moral requirement imposed by a divine sanction. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. He's putting civil authority in the same sort of category there as moral laws. Indeed, if you look a bit further down the page, it's quite clear that he sees civil authority as the secular agent of the for executing God's law in society. Rulers, he says, hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. He is God's servant for your good, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, he says, it's necessary to submit to the authorities, verse 5, not only because of possible punishment, in other words, not just because you fear, but because of conscience. Conscience, that is. A moral response to God. That, he says, is why it is necessary to submit to the authorities. Now, this is not a common idea today. Indeed, it's quite an extraordinary idea for many people today. But I think there's no question that is in fact what Paul is saying. Some want to argue that Paul is just reflecting here the fact that his own experience of the Roman Empire was generally good and that he's therefore politically naive. But that can't be true. Paul knew perfectly well that throughout Jewish history there had been enormous persecution of the righteous by governments. He knew it was a Roman governor who had ordered the execution of Christ. So Paul could not possibly have been naive about the negative features of government. Rather, what he's doing here is teaching us the theological foundation for civil authority as an institution. Civil authority, he says, is a reflection of divine authority. For there's no authority except that which God as sovereign personally exercises or mandates to others to exercise. And that's what he's done in the case of the state. In this sense, if you like, the ancien régime, the old system, was onto something right. It had got it, I suppose, through the medieval church. That God stood at the head of society. That he was the one to whom citizen and state were ultimately accountable. In fact, that, of course, is the conclusion that we have to draw once we've made this observation from Romans 13. What Paul is saying here is that there is a norm of civil obedience. It is right and normal for any Christian to obey the state. It is extremely abnormal for him to have to disobey the state, precisely because there is a moral authority behind the state. But it also, of course, implies norms for government too, doesn't it? For it isn't true that governments are above the law. Certainly not. They are under the law. Just because a government has won an election or feels it is the mouthpiece of the people, doesn't mean it can do what it likes. You know, there are certain things which governments may not do. Certain things which governments must do. For they're there to enforce the law of God. They're his servants. The power of the sword then is a sacred trust, and God will judge governments who abuse it, as well as citizens who despise it. That brings us to the second issue that I want to address and the second Bible passage I want us to look at. The possibility of civil disobedience. All right, Roy, we've seen from Romans 13 that the norm is civil obedience. But are there any circumstances in which it would be right or possible for a Christian to disobey the state? And I think we have to come to the conclusion that the answer to that question is yes. One of the reasons, it seems to me, that the old system in France failed to give people a right avenue of criticism on their government, which was reformatory rather than revolutionary, was the absence of that vertical line. Do you see it right down the middle there? From the Christian direct to God. Do you remember, in the old regime, the citizen was underneath the state and the church. He had no direct access to God. He didn't think of himself in that way. That was because in Catholic Europe, that was how the place of the ordinary individual, the ordinary Christian, was seen. And the authority of God was mediated to him, either through the state or through the church. He had no direct appeal to God, no direct relationship with God. I'm tempted to say that if France hadn't expelled the Huguenots and had listened to one of her greatest sons, John Calvin, with a little more care and sympathy, the French Revolution wouldn't have happened. But what Protestantism was trying to say is that we are not to think of human beings as subject to this kind of hierarchical tyranny by human institutions. Every individual has a direct relationship with God. Therefore, every individual has the ability to study God's word and to evaluate society and make a contribution towards society. That liberating, emancipating instinct of the Reformation was what France lacked, and one of the reasons that the whole of the old regime was so immobile and sticky and found it so difficult to understand how to bring about change, because people had not been psychologically emancipated to think of themselves as having worth through having a direct relationship with God. The only way they could establish their worth was by this brutal social catharsis of violence and violent overthrow of their oppressors. You find similar things, actually, in Catholic colonies today. Any of you who know the writings of Frantz Fanon, the Algerian rebel, would, I think, perceive a similar problem. It's only those who have really understood what it means to have a personal relationship with God direct, rather than via the hierarchy of the church, who are psychologically equipped to be reformers rather than revolutionaries. Fanon writes of very brutally, of the necessity for revolutionary violence in order to free the African from the inferiority complex to which he is victim. Now, that isn't true, you see. Not once a man has really understood that he has a direct relationship with God, that vertical line. Now, that vertical line there means for me that, yes, the possibility of civil disobedience does exist. It is possible, because I know myself accountable directly to God, to find my loyalty and allegiance to God in collision to my loyalty to the state, to be produced, to be in a situation, if you like, of conflict of loyalties, where I may have to choose lesser evils. In that sense, I don't think the Bible absolutizes obedience to the state. It says obedience to the state is a moral good, but like all moral goods, there are situations where it has to be set in balance against other moral goods, and where we have to choose lesser evils. Now, let me give you a few examples from the Bible where it seems civil disobedience is quite clearly performed and endorsed by God. An obvious one is in the book of Exodus, chapter 1, verse 17. The Egyptian midwives. Do you remember that Pharaoh told the Egyptian midwives that they were to kill all the boy babies born to Jewesses? Well, it was quite clearly contrary to the law of God, you see. No civil authority has the right to decree such a thing. Civil authority is under the law of God. Any civil authority which commands such a thing, the murder of the innocents, is putting itself not under the law, but over the law. Indeed, that's what Pharaoh did in Egypt. He was an absolute monarch. He thought of himself perhaps rather like Louis XVI did. An absolute monarch over everything, able to say just what he wanted, and it had to be done. Well, nobody brought up within an atmosphere of biblical theology could accede to that. And the Egyptian midwives didn't. They refused to do what Pharaoh had said. That's what Exodus 1:17 says. In a word, they disobeyed the state. They refused to do what the state had commanded them they should do. In that sense, they're reflecting exactly the same kind of personal discrimination, a personal kind of civil disobedience, as I would suggest to you, Nazi officers should have exercised in Hitler's forces during the last war, when they were commanded to perform atrocities. Perhaps, though, the most important example of this kind of civil disobedience, and the most familiar one to us as Christians, is the one we encounter in the New Testament, in Acts 4 and 5. In these verses, you remember, Peter and the other apostles have been commanded by the Sanhedrin not to preach the name of Jesus anymore. Told quite explicitly, they must be forbidden. We must warn these men, Acts 4, verse 17, to speak no longer to anyone in this name. And they called them in and commanded them not to speak or teach at all in the name of Jesus. And that's when Peter and John give this classic reply. Judge for yourselves whether it is right in God's sight to obey you rather than God, for we cannot help speaking about what we have seen and heard. And again in chapter 5, Peter and the other apostles reply, we must obey God rather than men. Here's another example then of civil disobedience. In this case, it's of Christians refusing to stop doing what the state had prohibited. It was the other way around. From the Egyptian midwives. They're an important, the grounds that the apostles cite in Acts 4 for their civil disobedience, I think, worthy of note. They appeal for a start to freedom of conscience. Judge for yourselves whether it is right in God's sight to obey you rather than God. In other words, they're saying, we insist, and you should insist too if you'd read your Bibles, that every individual has to be obedient to his own conscience in the sight of God. If a Christian in good conscience cannot agree that what the state is ordering is right, then he has no alternative but to disobey. To fail to do so is to deify the state. They appeal also, it seems to me, to freedom of speech. We cannot help speaking about what we have seen and heard. You see, a person who knows that certain things are true must bear testimony to what he knows or sacrifice his self-respect and his integrity. Now, Jesus said, silence these and the very stones would cry out For truth is more important than the convenience of civil authorities. Censorship of the gospel is something the Christian cannot accept. They have to preach. They have no choice in this matter. The word that's often used in the book of Acts for the courage of the apostles, parousia in the Greek, emphasizes this very point. It meant freedom of speech. The willingness to stand up frankly and declare the truth, something much valued in Greek democracy. Peter and John, you notice, don't quarrel here with the right of the authorities to imprison them. They're not appealing to freedom of conscience and freedom of speech as if these were self-evident constitutional rights that no government could legitimately refuse. Now, the point is, if the state is ideologically committed to a religion or philosophy other than Christianity, then it is going to finish up inevitably putting Christians in prison. It's bound to happen, because Christians cannot accept the terms of such a state. Either a state must persecute the Christians, or else it must switch its ideological commitment to the Christian one, or else it must adopt a modern policy of religious toleration. But one thing it cannot do is silence the Christians by civil decree. Christians will not obey such a command, for they must obey God rather than men. They're loyal and obedient servants of the government in every respect, but they are citizens of heaven first. Because the model of authority they have in their mind is this one. The state does not possess ultimate sovereignty. God does, and there's a vertical line between the Christian and God, which he has to discharge, an accountability he can't neglect. In fact, if you look at the end of chapter 4 to what Peter and John did on their release after this warning they'd received, I think this point comes out very clearly. In verse 24, when they heard this, they raised their voices together in prayer to God. Sovereign Lord, they said. Do you know what word is used there for sovereign? Despot. Despot. You see, Christians do believe in tyranny. The despotism of God. Sovereign Lord, they said. You made heaven and earth and the sea and everything in them. You spoke by the Holy Spirit through the mouth of your servant, our father David. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against his anointed one. And you see, they see the fulfillment of that psalm in their own experience. Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city to conspire against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. Now, Lord, consider their threats and enable your servants to speak your word with great parousia, with great openness, freedom of speech. So behind this this civil disobedience of Peter and the others lies a doctrine of the sovereignty of God over the state, you see. Now the question you're wanting me to ask is, well, how far does that go? You've given us an example of the Egyptian midwives not doing what the state told them to do. You've given us an example of Peter and John doing what the state said they shouldn't do. But neither of these involves violence. Neither of these is revolutionary in the sense that it amounts to an attempt to overthrow the present political regime and replace it with another. Can civil disobedience ever go that far for a Christian? Now, I think here we have to say that when we come to this issue, we are really in a tight spot where Christians, you will find, take a different line from one another. There is a very strong and respected tradition within the Christian church of passivism. And there's a very strong and respected tradition within the Christian church which, even if it is not pacifist in the full sense, insists that revolution is always, violent revolution is always wrong. I think one has to say that the difficulty with such a pacifist or non-revolutionary view is that it may neglect that there are sins of omission as well as commission. Now, Edmund Burke, a contemporary of the French Revolution, said, "The triumph of evil requires nothing more than that good men do nothing." Maybe it is evil to take up arms against a civil government. But isn't it also evil to allow the hungry to go unfed, the naked unclothed? Isn't it also evil to allow judicial murders to be taking place in prisons without fair trials? Can we wash our hands, like Pilate, of those sort of events and say, well, we're not doing them, the government's doing them. It's nothing to do with us. Are there not sins of omission as well as commission in that sort of context? Once a government, you see, becomes in itself evil, no longer respecting the law of God, but taking the law into its own hands and doing what it wants to do, one can't deny the Christian is in a desperately difficult situation. Ethically, he can't destroy the government. Ethically, he can't endorse the government. Ethically, he can't sit around and do nothing. That's the moral dilemma of this sort of situation. And it is why, of course, not all Christians will come to the same conclusions in these situations. And where I think it's probably true to say you have to judge every situation on its own merits, and it is very, very difficult to issue a blanket moral verdicts on this question. But since we are not ducking this question tonight, let me say that it does seem to me, at least arguable, that in certain circumstances, violent revolution might be justified as the lesser of two evils. For much the same reason that Augustine and the church generally down through the ages has felt that in certain circumstances it might be right to go to war with another nation. So-called just war, as it was often called by Augustine and other theologians down the ages, as a lesser of two evils. See, killing a man is an essentially immoral act. But most Christians would argue that in a fallen world it is sometimes necessary. I mean, in the extreme, if a lunatic is about to machine gun my family and I shoot him, I suspect I've done the right thing. The only way I can justify such an action, I agree, is as the lesser of two evils. Or maybe in the same way it's not impossible that a government might so abuse its power to the destruction of human life and dignity that to seek the overthrow of that government would also be the lesser of two evils. It doesn't turn a bad act into a good act, but it does recognise that in the expediency of this moral dilemma, sometimes you haven't got a good choice to make. Now, you may not agree with me that that is a possibility. The only biblical grounds I can cite for saying that you maybe ought to consider it is that there are examples in the Old Testament where men were quite clearly anointed by God or commanded by God to overthrow existing regimes. One thinks, for instance, of the way in which David was anointed as king while Saul still lived. And wasn't that a revolutionary act? Perhaps even more obvious was the anointing of Jehu by Elisha to overthrow the house of Ahab. Now, I'm not saying that one can build a huge amount on stories like that from the Old Testament. It's perfectly possible and right to argue that Israel was a unique situation and that these are individual cases and not general principles. But it seems to me a case can be made from them for a Christian participation in a violent revolution in a very extreme situation. However, if one is going to allow that very dangerous possibility, I think it's important to issue a few caveats. And the most important of those is that it is not enough to, and it isn't sufficient grounds to embark quite clearly on that kind of revolutionary activity, simply because you don't like the particular political complexion of the regime. See, it's not sufficient grounds for revolution that a government is not sufficiently democratic for my taste. The way a government acquires power, the kind of political system it enforces, the degree of liberty its citizens experiences, these in themselves do not constitute grounds for rebellion. For Paul in Romans 13 was talking about the Roman Empire. It was hardly a democratic society. Now, the only grounds on which you could possibly justify revolution is that the law of God is being so flagrantly disobeyed, the moral law of God is being so flagrantly disobeyed, that it is a lesser evil to overturn the state than to uphold it in power when it is itself an agent of evil. As I say, that's one thing you have to bear in mind then. It's not sufficient simply to say that I don't like the particular complexion of this state. The other thing you have to bear in mind, if you want to pursue this dangerous road of saying that in certain extreme situations a Christian might participate in violent revolution is what Peter has to say in the third passage we're going to look at. 1 Peter chapter 2, the passage we read earlier. Seems to me that one of the great tragedies of the French Revolution was that the church had become so enmeshed in the political system that those French revolutionaries, in overthrowing the state, turned to godless, pagan, secular kind of philosophy rather than to their Bibles to inform the new society they were trying to build. And I think it has to be said that one of the reasons they came to grief where, for example, the American Revolution produced a much more stable situation is precisely because where Jefferson said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that we are, that all human beings are, but from their creator they have certain inalienable rights. So even though he wasn't really a Puritan believer like his great-great-grandfather, he put God there as the authority. And the American Constitution was perceived as representing the higher moral law, which no state could interfere with. Because it looked to God as the moral foundation for the state, because of its Puritan roots, the French revolutionaries overthrew all that and tried to enthrone goddess reason and goddess liberty in the place of God. And so many of the atrocities that arose out of that false kind of idea of democracy and a political power, it seems to me, could have been avoided if they hadn't done that. And fundamentally the reason they did that was because the church had allowed herself to be compromised. She no longer represented the truth of God. She had become a pawn, a political pawn. She'd become corrupt, seeking worldly power for herself. And that isn't, is it, the model of the church which Peter is describing for us here in 1 Peter 2, when he says, you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. There's absolutely no suggestion here that the church should be a political institution wielding direct political influence in the world. Absolutely none. On the contrary, in the New Testament, the church is meant to be a community representing not this world at all, but heaven. There's a very real sense in which the church doesn't belong to this age. Do you see how he says, verse 11, as aliens and strangers in the world. That's how the early Christians perceived themselves, you see. As people who didn't really belong here. The church really wasn't an institution that belonged to this age. It was something which God had placed in this age as a testimony, but it belonged to the age to come. The church was here, he says, as a chosen people to declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Now, I've tried to reflect that in this model here by the complete absence of any horizontal line between the state and the church. Now, I don't want to offend my Anglican brothers and sisters. I know I do this all the time. But I have to say they've fallen into the same trap. In fact, it's interesting, isn't it, that the Anglican Church has become an instrument of real Christian witness in the political arena in recent years in a way that it had never been for the last couple of hundred years, precisely because that horizontal line between state and church is drastically being weakened today. It's only now that the Church of England no longer feels itself to be part of the establishment, in which there's a strong movement within the Church of England for disestablishment. It's only now that it's beginning to have some kind of radical political voice. Before that, it was just, I'm afraid, one has to say, perhaps not quite at such extreme, but it would still be true to say, in some ways like the Catholic Church in pre-revolutionary France, a bolster of the status quo. The bishop sat in the House of Lords with the aristocracy. Now, as I say, that doesn't seem to me to be the right way in which the church should see herself. And if I expose my Anabaptist kind of leanings in saying that, you must forgive me. The testimony of the church under oppression. See what Peter is saying here. He's writing to those Christians in the middle of the first century who by all the criteria of modern libertarianism were the victims of intolerable oppression. They were subject to political tyranny under one of the most ruthless military dictatorships the world had ever known. They had no vote. Their rulers were foreign bureaucrats imposed upon them from an imperial palace hundreds of miles away. They were exposed to economic exploitation. By far the majority of them, as Peter clearly indicates, were slaves. And a slave in the first century was regarded as little more than a cart horse. Indeed, I think that's what Aristotle, or one Latin author anyway, actually says. He says the only difference between a slave and a cart horse is that a slave can speak. A slave in the Roman mind was an articulate agricultural implement. Now, it wouldn't be right, of course, to suggest that all slaves were treated with cruelty in the Roman Empire. But in terms of those fundamental human rights of which the United Nations Charter speaks today, they had none of them. But more than that, these people that he was writing to were not just victims of political oppression and economic exploitation. They were victims of religious prejudice, for they were Christians. And in Peter's day, the state was turning against Christianity. Persecution was probably not yet official. But the powers that be, which had once stepped in to defend the Apostle Paul against the lynch mob, were now beginning to turn a blind eye when Christians experienced injustice and victimization and discrimination. They were becoming an underprivileged, unpopular minority. And in Rome, Nero was beginning to fan the flames, quite literally, of that religious prejudice into bitter hatred. So whatever way you looked at their situation, freedom was something the early Christians had very little of. And there can be little doubt that if any group was as oppressed politically and economically as socially as they were today, they would be fertile soil for revolutionary ideology. You can just imagine the sort of tract that would have been circulating among them. Christians disdain to conceal your views, openly declare that your ends can only be obtained by the forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions. Let the Roman authorities tremble at the Christian revolution. The Christians have nothing to lose but their chains, and they have a world to win. Christians of all countries, unite. And so that's the sort of stuff that goes down well with oppressed minorities. If Peter had written that, he'd have been a popular man. Fortunately or unfortunately, whichever way you look at it, these are not the words of Peter, of course, with a few minor modifications. They're the words of Karl Marx. They are the closing words of the Communist Manifesto. Now, what we have to face up to this evening is unpalatable, I think, to many in our day. It is that the instruction which the apostle actually gives to these victims of tyranny and exploitation and persecution is not fight for your freedom, but yield to your oppressor. Twice he uses a word which I strongly suspect would have stuck in the gullet of Karl Marx. Submit, he says, verse 13. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men. You mean Nero? Yes. To the king. As supreme authority, or to his governors who were sent by him. Then again in verse 18, slaves, submit. Do you mean to my master? Yes, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. The contrast with modern revolutionary thought could not be more stark. Where the revolutionist encourages rebellion, Peter urges obedience. Where the revolutionist nourishes a spirit of sullen resentment, Peter seeks to inspire an attitude of cheerful service here. Now, on what possible grounds can he advocate such a policy of non-violent subservience? Surely he's just confirming the old criticism that Christianity is a social narcotic, an opium of the people, designed to keep the slaves content. Now, I don't think that's what Peter's showing at all here. Peter's grounds for arguing this are really quite unanswerable, aren't they? Do you see where they come? Verse 21. To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. Because the model of Christ which Peter holds out to these Christians in a situation of oppression, as the way in which, as a church, they were to respond. You know, Israel was a proud and ancient nation, And it's little wonder that there were terrorist assassinations and guerrilla bands in the hills in the first century. In fact, Galilee in the first century was the Falls Road of Judea, a seething mass of nationalist discontent, political violence and revolutionary insurgency. It was commonplace in Galilee. It was by violence the Roman army had subjugated the Jews. And there were many in Jesus' day who were sure it could only be by violence that they would be liberated from its cruelty. And so they waited, didn't they, for a God who would send them a Messiah of violence, a supernatural warrior who would, like David of old, single-handedly defeat the Goliath of Roman imperialism, restore their national independence. And just for a moment they thought they'd found him, didn't they? People said he was the Messiah. He grew great crowds like the Messiah would. Most significant of all, he worked miracles like the Messiah, amazing miracles. No wonder they got excited when he rode into Jerusalem. Hosanna, they said, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. Rescue. Hosanna in the highest. But within a week, their euphoria had evaporated away and their hopes had been dashed. He didn't deliver Jerusalem at all. He just stood on a hill overlooking it and cried his eyes out. He didn't invoke an army of angels to lay siege to the Roman garrison. He just sat there like a sitting duck, unarmed, in a secluded spot after dark and waited for the authorities to come and arrest him. He didn't, like Elijah, call down fire from heaven, or like Samson, demolish the governor's palace with his bare hands. He just hung there, pathetically, on a cross that they gave him, and hurled questions at heaven about why his God had forsaken him. So no wonder they cried for Barabbas. Maybe Barabbas couldn't work miracles, but at least there was spite in Barabbas. At least Barabbas had been sentenced to death because he'd killed Romans, not just because he'd been so ineffectual and incompetent as to let them catch him without a struggle. Why, this fellow only had two swords to his name. And when they were drawn to resist the posse that had come to take him prisoner, he told them to put them away. Now, Barabbas may not have been the Messiah, but at least he wasn't a wimp. At least he wasn't a pacifist. At least he wasn't a coward. At least he didn't lie down under Roman tyranny and accept crucifixion like a sacrificial lamb. Now give us Barabbas. Give us Barabbas every time in preference to Jesus. And in revolutionary violence the whole world round, I fear the same cry goes up, even today. Men outraged by the oppression of their enemies still prefer to put their trust in Barabbas rather than in Jesus. In messiahs of violence rather than crucified Christs. Well, this evening I suggest to you we have to allow Peter, the very disciple who was the first to lift his sword, remember that dark betrayal night, we have to allow him to instruct us in this matter. In what you might call, if you want to call it that, the politics of the cross. Jesus did bring freedom to the slave. Don't we believe that? But he did it not by exterminating his oppressor, but by spiritually emancipating the oppressed. The revolution he worked was first and foremost not a political or economic revolution in the structure of ancient society. It was first and foremost a revolution in the slave's own perception of himself in relationship to God. The servant role, far from being a mark of gross indignity, became for the Christian a noble role, because Jesus himself had not been ashamed to call himself a slave. So, says Peter, to be a suffering slave is no grounds for wallowing in self-pity, nor yet for fuming resentment. To be a suffering slave for the Christian, he says, is a privilege. Do you know the word he actually uses in this passage? When he says it is commendable in verse 19 and again in verse 20? He says literally, it is a grace. It is a grace when you suffer innocence as a slave, he says. For Christ himself suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps.